The views expressed on the following program are the views of the show's host and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station, their management, their donors, their underwriters, nor their seventh-born sons. Broadcasting from our secret underground studio in Olympia, Washington, it is time for the Thunderbolts. Yes, kids, there you were, enjoying your privileged white status, blissfully ignorant of the fact that your shoes were manufactured by a child slave, until one day you turned on your radio and you were struck by the Thunderbolt! Hello, Cascadia! It's time to wake up! Yes, you better grab that cup of coffee, because you are about to be struck by the thunderbolt of truth and justice. Here it comes. Yes, kids, the thunderbolt is your guide to activism in Thurston County. I have news. I have commentary, I have a calendar for activist-related events, kick-ass music, and dumb jokes! So Cascadia is off of the couch and into the streets! It's time to save civilization from fiery apocalypse! Though even the apocalypse is gonna have to wait until I have had a cup of coffee! So, I was recently forced by my phone company to abandon my flip phone and get a smartphone. Whilst learning to use it, I was having a hard time making it do what I wanted it to do. And when I inadvertently opened the Google Assistant, which was not what I was looking to do, I groaned and said, quote, F this shite. The Google Assistant dutifully printed F this shite on my screen. And then, to my utter astonishment, a freaking computer program saw fit to lecture me about my frigging language. Yes, people, this nanny state bullshite is getting very real. Jeez. I took a screenshot of the admonition just to prove that it actually happened. Anyway, here is what the Google Assistant on my phone said to me. Quote, I'm a virtual assistant, but your words are still very real. Please keep them respectful. If you're frustrated with something, I'm open to your feedback. Unquote. I'm thinking of sending them some feedback that contains a large number and wide variety of very real, yet highly disrespectful words, pointing out that the Google Assistant is not my frigging mother. And I haven't decided yet. I like that. Might get me on a goggle shite list or something. I'm out of here, boy. It's my jam. It's my jam. All right. Welcome to the Thunderbolt for March 3rd, 2023. You know, I just love it when I can use a title that has a double or triple meaning. And we're going to start off this week's show with a piece about our ballooning national crisis. Yes, people, we have a bunch of hot air over America. Yes, a bunch of hot air has been emanating out of Washington, D.C. lately. And it's all over a bunch of hot air that recently passed through our national airspace that was encased within a Chinese hot air balloon. Well, actually, it was a helium balloon. That totally wrecks my metaphor. So has anyone besides me asked why everyone has their panties in such a twist over 19th century surveillance tech, when the Chinese have satellites that can read your license plate from outer space? Ah, but the great Chinese balloon conspiracy derailed some high-level talks between Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and his Chinese counterparts. So this brings us back to another old Thunderbolt adage. Anytime anything happens, look to who is profiting from that thing happening. And the bulk of the time, you will also have found the person who is making that thing happen. Up, up and away, my beautiful, So, who benefits from, quote, him blowing up, unquote, the Chinese balloon conspiracy, thus canceling those talks? Just saying. So a reader of the Thunderbolt newsletter pointed out that in that publication, I praised the German Coast Slave Rebellion, which was an armed uprising. At the same time that I advocate non-violent civil disobedience. So I've covered this before, but I'm most happy to cover it again. I advocate non-violent civil disobedience, not because I'm a pacifist, because frankly, I'm not. I advocate non-violence in political activism, because all things being equal, nonviolent civil disobedience not only succeeds roughly twice as often at achieving their goals as armed rebellions do, but the outcomes also tend to be much better when they are brought about by nonviolent means.
with armed rebellions, in fact. You more often than not merely end up trading one tyrant for another. In addition, there is a phenomenon wherein having a bunch of radical bomb throwers can greatly strengthen the bargaining positions of the non-violent people. They can often get things done that they couldn't have gotten done had not ultra-violent nationalist movements been operating contemporaneously. Such as it was with Martin Luther King. Such as it was with Mahatma Gandhi. Also, in the world of politics, things tend often to be very unequal. If you are being brutally oppressed by someone who is able to deploy omnipotent force, then that equation of violent methods versus non-violent methods can often lead to a different outcome. But speaking of pacifists, as I have been regularly reporting for a long time now, the Pacifica Radio Network is experiencing serious dire straits. KPFA in Berkeley just had federal marshals seize $350,000 from their bank account, all because their sister station, WBAI in New York, lost a libel lawsuit. And in the entire Pacifica network, it turned out that KPFA had the only bank account that was large enough to cover WBAI's jet. And in addition, the Pacifica National Board is now threatening to sell KPFK's building and broadcast license in Los Angeles. Now keep in mind, the KPFK has a 100,000 watt broadcast signal right in the middle of Los Angeles, and that they have several repeater stations strung out all over Southern California. One of the largest, if not the largest, media market in the United States. Now, a lot of the blame for a lot of this seems to lay with a couple of local station boards of directors, but the most criticism is being aimed directly at the National Board of Directors. Now, I have absolutely no evidence for this, and I have not heard even the harshest critics of the National Board even hint at this. But I can almost guarantee you the government agents provocateur has wormed their way onto Pacifica's National Board of Directors, and that they are intentionally sabotaging the network. And the reason I can almost guarantee this is because that is what they always do anytime any voice of opposition becomes prominent, and the Pacifica Network is by orders of magnitude the largest source of alternative media and actual factual reporting that is left in the entire country. A whole bunch of very powerful people would love to see KPFK off the air, and a whole bunch of very powerful media interests would love to get their greedy little paws on that 100,000-watt broadcasting license. Go to pacificainexile.org for more information. And as far as all of the blatant in-your-face censorship that is coming at us these days from both the left and the right, we should all actually rejoice at that. Before the right-wingers turned it into a gas-lit bonfire, critical race theory was only being taught in a few graduate-level university courses. For those of you who have been living under a rock, critical race theory teaches American history as it actually happened, as opposed to the sugar-coated BS that dominates the current meme. Now, thanks to all of the free advertisement being spewed forth like an open fire hydrant from right-wingers, critical race theory has now become famous. And it's the same with all of the banned books. Any ambitious author should actually try to get someone to ban their book, because you cannot pay for that kind of free advertisement. So, it is illegal for the government to censor our free speech. However, it is perfectly legal for private companies to do so. And information is now coming to public light that a small army of former national security agents from the whole panoply of U.S. government three-letter spook agencies has deeply infiltrated the boardrooms in high executive positions on all of the major social media platforms, and that they are dictating which stories we see and which stories we don't see. Surprise, surprise, not. That is, if you listen to the Thunderbolt anyway. Them doing that, of course, is illegal as hell. But of course, that doesn't matter anymore. Yes, people, in the case of Bedbook and Twatter, we now know from the Twatter files that the government was indeed working directly with Big Tech to censor information and put out a large number and a wide variety of false narratives. And we know from the Twatter files that both Bedbook and Twatter directly interfered in several foreign elections. Evidently, what is good for the goose is not good for the gander in the case of American hypocrisy. But we already knew that as well. In the case of Bedbook and Twatter, this state of affairs should not be surprising, as both of those companies were originally seeded with cash from NQTEL, which, as I have reported here in the Thunderbolt several times before, NQTEL is the venture capital arm of the CIA. And both Bedbook and Twatter have now become Trojan horses for censorship by proxy under the guise of, quote, policing misinformation. unquote. But that leads me to a question. Who is going to police the police? The government? Yeah, that's really funny. Especially since the upper echelons of bedbook management are infested with ex-high-ranking officials from the CIA. We now know from the Twatter files that FBI agents were directly calling employees at Twatter, who were themselves ex-FBI agents, and then telling them who and what to censor on a daily basis. Twatter has so many ex-FBI agents on their payroll, in fact, that they even have their own Slack channel. And the CIA is omnipresent in this milieu. The man who made the decision to kick Donald Trump off of Twatter, for instance, was named Aaron Berman. Mr. Berman had previously held such a high position within the CIA that he was the one who gave both Barack Obama and Donald Trump their daily briefings. So does anyone else think it's really weird that someone would go from a position so high in the CIA to then suddenly make such a bizarre career move as to become an executive at Twatter? Not these days. Yes, people. There seems to be a lot of very well-oiled revolving doors popping up almost everywhere these days. At least in that world. Fedbook and Twatter are not the only ones, of course. This paradigm actually applies to pretty much all of the major social media outlets, including Instagram, TikTok, Reddit, Google, of course, and many others. And as for Elon Musk, the supposedly libertarian renegade entrepreneur, well, Mr. Musk is actually a key cog in the surveillance state. Throughout the early 2000s, the head of NQTEL, Mike Griffin, personally mentored Musk, and in 2002, Griffin personally accompanied Musk to Moscow in order to purchase some intercontinental ballistic missiles with the aim of helping him in setting up SpaceX. Then, when SpaceX ran into financial difficulties, Griffin, who was by then the head of NASA, managed to steer first a $400 million NASA contract to SpaceX, and then later another $1.6 billion with a B dollar contract. Musk was subsequently responsible for a lot of the surveillance technology and practices that Edward Snowden later risked his life to reveal to us. Then meanwhile, good old Jeff Bezos was signing a $600 million contract with the CIA at about the same time that he was purchasing the Washington Post. there are also massive security state interventions in the world of entertainment, especially in Hollywood. The examples are endless. The FBI has been using Hollywood movies as a propaganda outlet ever since the 1920s, and the CIA boasts about their influence on their webpage. And now, even the world of video games has basically become a massive military psyop. All the more reprehensible in this case because they are specifically targeting highly impressionable youth who are right in the middle of forming their worldviews. And now those impressionable young minds are having pro-military propaganda injected directly into their brains without their even knowing it. People generally don't deploy their anti-propaganda filters when they're playing a frigging game. Yet first-person shooter games often feature events that are happening in the real world, accompanied by the traditional war machine propaganda spin upon those events. There was recently a game whose object was to overthrow the Venezuelan government, for instance. Again, the examples in video game world are also endless. A journalist named Alan McLeod is all over this, and you can find the documentation for all of this and much more at Mint Press News. And Alan McLeod is AlanMcCleod. MintPressNews.com is just like it sounds. And now it's time to take a quick station break. We'll be back in just a minute.
This program is a production of Dancing Angel Media, which is solely responsible for the content. If this program makes your head explode or causes emotional distress, or if you suddenly feel as if life suddenly isn't worth living anymore due to the things you learn on this program, then you should blame yourself for the fact that you're such a wimp that you let the world push you around in such a manner, rather than blaming the producers of some radio show, much less blaming the radio station that is airing the show. And you should maybe soon become a Zen master and or a used car salesman and or an astronaut or whatever, rather than trying to educate yourself about things that are simply going to twist your worldview into a pretzel, making your continued existence on this plane problematic. If you have useful suggestions, or if you wish to participate in meaningful debate, then bring it on. But otherwise, if you aren't going to help, then please just shut up and get out of our way, so that we can do what needs to be done. Have a nice day.
All right, we are back. So the Beecher Thunderbolt this week represents the final installment in our little mini-series covering activist heroes from history. This week we cover what is often called the Greatest Generation. They're called this largely because they are credited with defeating the Nazi war machine during World War II. Well, not to denigrate their accomplishments, but at best, the Americans merely provided an assist, as actually it was the Russians who defeated the Nazi war machine. Indeed, the D-Day invasion would have been utterly impossible had not fully 75% of Hitler's forces been on the Eastern Front fighting the Russians. This contention is evidenced by the fact that around 30 million Russians died in World War II, whilst American losses were just over 1/4 of 1 million. Whatever. The Americans who participated in World War II did indeed accomplish major feats regardless. World War II is often referred to as the Good War, or at worst, as a necessary war. And therefore, protesting World War II was a very unpopular thing to do at that time, especially after Pearl Harbor. Even the famous pacifist Albert Einstein said something to the effect that he was a pacifist, except when it came to Adolf Hitler. Yet many did resist that war anyway. In fact, many went to prison rather than to submit to conscription, for instance. Therefore, I think it would not be out of line to refer to these World War II protesters as, if not the greatest generation, perhaps the bravest generation. I also think it would not be out of line to refer to these World War II protesters as heroes. The cast of characters amongst the World War II protesters contained a lot of names that you are probably familiar with, along with a lot of names you are probably completely unfamiliar with. In addition, the World War II protesters faced so much persecution that the experiences provided a lot of them with valuable training on things like dealing with incarceration and facing serious social disrepute. The Pacifica Radio Network, in fact, was founded in 1946 by a group of recently persecuted war protesters, for instance. And in fact, it was these people who originally came up with the very idea of listener-sponsored radio. The word Pacifica, in fact, refers to pacifists. The War Resisters League was founded in 1923, and the War Resisters League was an offshoot of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Yes, that is the very same Fellowship of Reconciliation that is responsible for those peace vigils that have been happening every Friday at Heritage Park for decades. And this is the very same Fellowship of Reconciliation that was the loudest anti-war voice in Olympia for the entire time that I lived there. This split between the two organizations came about largely because at that time, the Fellowship of Reconciliation was a purely religious organization, and the War Resisters League wanted to go both in a more secular and a more radical direction than the Fellowship was willing to go at that time. When war broke out, the small hardcore of remaining pacifists recognized that they were not going to stop the war, and that in fact such efforts would probably lead to government suppression, because most people supported the war, including almost all the churches and including organized labor. And that is important because this represented the initial splitting of the left from the labor movement. And yes, the Wobblies were long gone by then. Yes, people, there was really nothing there for the anti-war people during World War II. They did have a conscientious objector status, but the only way you could obtain that was on religious grounds. And even then, you were still expected to contribute to the war effort in some manner. You could go into the army in some sort of non-combat role, or if you didn't want to do that, you could volunteer to go live in what was called a, quote, civilian public service camp, unquote, to do work of, quote, national importance, unquote. In other words, showing their usual level of genius, with these camps, the government created a crucible to temper and strengthen anti-war activists. And not only that, but they mixed lots of different kinds of activists who normally would probably have never even met, much less worked together. Yes, people, there were anarchists, socialists, Christian pacifists, and even some Jewish pacifists, as well as many others. They talked, they debated, they had classes, and they would even receive visits from people the likes of Bayard Rustin, who would often come to these camps to give lectures. And yes, as I said, Lou Hill, the founder of the Pacifica Network, was educated in one of these camps, and, as mentioned, it was in that camp that he and others came up with the very idea of the Pacifica Radio Network. Yes, in these camps, people started publishing newsletters. They created art. And it was just an incredibly vibrant world. Yet at the same time, it was also a somewhat depressing one, because they were not paid anything, and because they increasingly saw the work they were given as pointless. Though some of them did volunteer to put out very dangerous forest fires in the West, and thousands of others volunteered to work in mental institutions, which at that time were a Dickensian archipelago of facilities that had very little treatment, little funding, violent staff, inadequate clothing and food, and literally represented an insane horror show. When the pacifists first came into these hospitals, for at least a little while, they managed to change some things to the extent that they could by drawing public attention through media exposés. They even started a newsletter to circulate best practices with one another. They had no particular training, but then again, neither had the regular staff, which had gone off either to work in the more lucrative war factories, or had gone themselves into the armed forces. Another result of this experience is that sometimes the pacifists found themselves locked in a room with up to 100 mentally ill people, some of them quite dangerous. The staff had no weapons, nor did they want any, but many pacifists thus learned that at least when dealing with mentally ill people, that sometimes restraint, if not violence, was necessary. Whatever. As a result of many things, a spirit of ever greater radicalism began to take hold in these camps. And that spirit was destined to become highly influential for decades to come. Another change brought about by World War II, as far as the anti-war movement was concerned, is that from the Civil War until World War II, the anti-war movements and pacifist movements had all been, well, passive. They used nonviolent tactics and resisted with simple non-compliance. The American pacifists during World War II, though, started to transform that passive resistance movement into an active and much more in-your-face type movement for righting the many obvious wrongs that have been plaguing society. And thus, immediately following World War II, the War Resisters League was basically taken over by radical pacifists. And this is where such future luminaries as David Dellinger of Chicago 7 fame got his start, along with many others who were equally disreputable, if not as famous. And before he became part of the Chicago 7, Dellinger was part of something that was known as the Union 8. And these were 8 young men at the Union Theological Seminary in New York, and they were training to become Protestant clergymen. When the first peacetime draft was adopted, they were supposed to register in October of 1940. But they refused to register, even though by registering, they would be exempt due to the fact that they were seminary students. Yes, people, these were the original draft resistors. Union 8 made national headlines, and their story was featured on the front page of the New York Times, and so on. And they were all sent to prison. And that was but Dellinger's first stint in prison, as he did even more prison time later in the war. Again, for refusing to be drafted. Thus, Mr. Dellinger already had a long history with all of this, and by the time he was part of the Chicago 7, he was an extremely experienced, thoughtful, and hardened veteran of resistance. And Dellinger was what one of many direct threads connecting these greatest generation war protesters to the great social movements of the 1960s. Including a little-known character named Reverend A.J. Mustie, M-U-S-T-E, who is basically a mentor to all these other people. And thus were the seeds of our revolution sown. All of the information in this section of the show came from a book called War by Other Means by a gentleman named Daniel Axt, A-K-S-T. And now, it's time to get to work. All right. And for the music selection this week,
thank you.
We're going to go for some old-time rock and roll.
I'd like to thank my friends here who gave me this little whip. It's really lovely. I'll keep it and cherish it forever. Mm-hmm.
We'll be right back.
the light, baby. I can't stand it now. Not talking about the light up above, I'm talking about the hellfire down below. That's right, that's a Lucifer light. I said I'm talking about Lucifer. L-U-C-I-F-E-R. I spell it Lucifer. Alright. I know Lucifer so well, I call him by his first name.
What do you call him?
I said, I call him, hey Lou.
And if he don't answer?
I said, hey Lou, lover boy.
Don't mean Reed.
He's gonna come and take you away.
Take you.
Take you away.
Take you.
ME262 from the Blue Oyster Cult. Awesome. So please keep in mind that the views expressed on the Thunderbolt are those of the show's host and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station or anyone associated with this radio station. The Thunderbolt website is dana98501.wordpress.com. 98501 is the downtown Olympia zip code, if that helps you remember that. And you can contribute to the Thunderbolt cause at patreon.com/thethunderbolt. Glad you joined us this week. We hope to see you next week. And in the meanwhile...
Thank you very much.